Hey Tacoma, what's up? John Doherty here for Radio Tacoma's Climate Talk, the place where we talk about everything climate, always respectfully, ever striving to be fact-based, open to divergent perspectives, and always actively optimistic. Today we're talking with Yasmine Trudeau, who is State Senator for the 27th Legislative District. The 27th LD is our district right here in Tacoma. Senator Trudeau was appointed to that position last fall by the Pierce County Council, following the retirement of Jeannie Darnielle. We'll be talking with Senator Trudeau about her decision to take that position, what her experience has been so far, her thoughts about the impact of climate change in our area, and some looking ahead towards 2023 and the legislative session. So here we go. We're really pleased, happy, privileged to have Senator Yasmine Trudeau, 27th Legislative District here in Washington State. That's the homie for those who are listening to this station. So, Senator Trudeau, welcome. It's great to have you.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So let's just jump right in. Politics seems like a really tough job to me, and I'm wondering why anybody would want to be in politics, especially in a place like a legislature. So tell us your thinking about why you're doing this thing for us.
Well, you're not wrong. So let me start there. A couple of things. You know, I've been engaged in the world of politics, but never as a leader in that space, right? I've supported some really great electeds. I've learned the legislative process. My job before this was actually as legislative affairs director for Attorney General Bob Ferguson, who I find to be just really good at his job, both the politicking and also the just being our AG, especially over the last couple of years. So I've been able to watch some folks that I think do really great work. But I never actually thought about running myself or seeking the seat until all of a sudden in October, former State Senator Jeannie Darnielle announced that she was retiring. And my brain as a sort of organizer is thinking about who did I know in the 27th? And I started getting calls and they were like, no, silly, you live in the 27th. So I had about 5 days to make my decision about whether I was going to shoot my shot. And I think what motivated me in those 5 days, which, you know, I don't know, it was so fast and furious, was the ability to take all of the skills that I had learned in working with the legislature and the relationships that I developed there, but also to bring in my lived experience. And the things that I've gone through, which are pretty unique, I think, to most folks, especially that pursue a career in the Senate. So figuring out how to be able to use that was exciting for me. So, but you're not wrong. And there are definitely moments where I was like, oh, it's a lot easier to be behind the scenes than out front. But I'm glad I did it. I got through my frustrations. I'm sure there'll be many, many more ahead.
Well, I will just thank you for taking on the task, because as tough as it is, it's so important. And it's, you know, if good people don't take the offices, then not good people are going to take the offices. So thank you for stepping up to this tough job. So there's a primary coming up. I don't know the answer to this. Are you going to have a primary challenger?
So I have two folks who have filed against me, both from the Republican Party. I don't know either of them, and I'm never going to be in a position to disparage anybody that runs against me, because it's a democracy. And I think as many people that are involved and lend their voice is great. But, you know, the 27th has been a historically blue district, and this is the community I grew up in. I graduated from FOSS, and I feel comfortable if the constituents want me back, that I'll do what I can for them. So I feel pretty good.
Yeah. Okay. So in other words, you're not expecting to have a Democratic challenger for the position in the primary?
Not at this point, but, you know, we're about we've still got a week and some change, I think, before the deadline. So it could happen, but I haven't heard of anything. And so I don't want to discourage anyone, but I hope it stays that way.
Yeah. Well, it is, as you say, it is a Democratic process, and I suppose if there's an aspect of more the merrier, the voters get to be exposed to a variety of opinions. And that's a healthy thing, I'm sure. So this is a climate program. So as a senator from the 27th Legislative District, when you think about climate and climate change and the environment in general, what do you see as the priorities, and maybe even tie them to legislative priorities too?
Sure. So, I mean, environmental, I'll start by saying I'm not an expert in environmental policy. And I come to, you know, I come to this work sort of really like being able to dig in on policy work. So whenever I am venturing into an area, I'll say that I lead with my values if I don't know the specific specifics of the proposals. So, I mean, my values are that it's a threat that we can't ignore. It's immediate and it's urgent. And I think my focus in bringing that lived experience is to focus on climate justice. I think there's a lot of great work in the environmental, you know, universe, if you will. There's great advocates, great organizations. I think where I'd like to bridge the gap is on the piece of environmental justice, particularly the impacts, the disproportional impacts on certain communities, depending on where they live, socioeconomic, racial and ethnic status. So figuring out how we can bring everyone to the table and talk about how to center those that tend to be most disproportionately impacted.
So do you ever see any conflict between concerns for the environment and concerns for environmental or climate justice? And don't misunderstand me in this question. I mean, I get the notion or the need that if we're going to address climate change, we have to address it across the board. And part of the reason we have the problem we have is because certain communities are bearing an unfair part of the consequences of our environmental practices. Are there cases where these two issues are in conflict?
I don't know about in conflict, but I think that the environmental community, and I want to give credit to some of the transitions and priority shifts over the last couple of years that I've seen, where a lot of the environmental leaders and organizations are thinking more about how to bring folks that haven't been historically at the table to the table. So I think there's been a concerted effort to mm-hmm. do that. But I think where conflicts arise is where folks are just, you know, maybe not thinking. It's more an unintentional piece, like, okay, well, we didn't consider that community because that community hasn't been historically at the table. So I don't see them in conflict. I actually see more effort going into bringing the two together. One area that I feel really passionate about is when we are transitioning into more, you know, climate-friendly solutions and opportunities, is how do we bring sort of our working-class folks that have been in sectors maybe that are not aligned with some of our environmental priorities and concerns, how do we make sure that we're supporting them in that transition? So someone once told me, like, you know, if you want someone to care about the climate, make it their job. You know, so I think there's something to be said about not losing folks that have not been part of the conversation as we transition and want people to prioritize more green jobs and things of that nature. So that's what I'd like to work on, is that bridge building.
Yeah, so I think that's a really a terrifically important perspective that you bring there. I've been active around climate issues for, let's just say, a number of years, and there is a gap. The organizations that I'm active with typically are dominated by white middle class people, and getting across that gap, which I think is critically important, is a challenge. So I'm with you on facing up to that. I personally, you know, I really don't know what to do.
Yeah. It's a hard one. I mean, it's a hard one, but I think, you know, and I will back up a little bit, you know, transitioning from the sort of behind the scenes staff role to the, I guess, front of the camera, you know, folks are constantly asking, well, what's your solution? Right. And it's a weird thing, because I'm like, well, I feel like solutions ought to be like, you come up with solutions by asking the right questions, and you ask the right questions to the right people. So I feel like we're on track to be able to do that. I think we need to probably, I think we could do better. But I'd like to hear from the folks that are in those transitions, right? Like, well, how do they want to see this work? Cause it feels really awkward for me to say, this is how I think you should do something when I've never done it.
Yeah, I hear you. And it there is a degree of awkwardness, but I also see your point that this is far from a hopeless situation. I mean, all we need to do is roll up our sleeves and go to work and take some chances. Yes. As Miss Frizzle of the Magic School Bus used to say, you know, get messy, take chances, and have fun. So,
can I tell you how much I love that you're quoting Miss Frizzle? I was just watching Magic School Bus with my toddler this morning. Oh, and I was so excited that he's actually into a cartoon that I can, it brings back all this nostalgia and that I can watch with him. So I digress, but any opportunity to quote Miss Frizzle, you're going to win with me.
Yeah, awesome. Well, I'm the dad of six kids, and I've spent many hundreds of hours watching Miss Frizzle, and I fell in love with her myself. So
she's wonderful.
Yeah, she is. She probably would be really, really good in politics too. I don't know. Maybe she would irritate some folks, but anyway.
Irritation's not bad.
Yeah, exactly. So one of the things that we tend to think about addressing climate change and environmental issues is, well, it's going to cost us money to address these issues. Mm-hmm. It's going to hurt the economy. You know that drill. So what are your thoughts about, can we have a healthy, vibrant economy and take with good jobs and good businesses and take care of our environment too? Can we do that?
I think we can do that. And I'd say we have to do that. You know, there's this issue of, you know, how much does something cost? And I say you pay now or you pay more later. And so it depends on how you look at, you know, what you want to prioritize fiscally, right? We do that in our own budgets, our individual budgets in our homes and our, you know, whether we maintenance our cars, how much does something cost up front to save us, you know, on the back end. So when I think about money, I think it's a worthy investment. One, because when we talk about climate, my goodness, we all have to live here on Earth. And so the data is clear that something has to happen. So the hand wringing on how much it's going to cost, I think, really doesn't do the conversation justice, but it's important because there is a cost. But, you know, having looked at budgets and having actually been staff to the Senate Democratic Caucus on Ways and Means for Capital Budget, you know, there it's not about whether there is money to do it. It's about whether you prioritize where the money goes. So I just think pay now or pay later. And I'd rather pay now so that my kids can have a better opportunity in the future.
Yeah, I hear you. All the numbers, or let's say at least most of the numbers I look at, are real clear that there's huge costs waiting for us downstream if we don't the investments. Now, you're probably not old enough to remember this, but I can remember there used to be a TV commercial where the mechanic was saying just what you said. He says, you can pay me now or you can pay me later. And he was sort of like, well, I don't care which one you choose, but maybe you want to take good care of your vehicle and get a good lifetime out of it. So the legislative session, it's next January starting up. So is there talk already or any way of knowing what's going to be going on in terms of legislative proposals, especially around climate?
Not at the moment. I mean, there's a lot of folks right now that are up for re-election. There's going to be some restrictions on what folks do. And so I imagine we're going to know more by early fall, late summer. There's also a lot of shakeups. I can tell you in the Senate, we've had a climate leader, Senator Reuven Carlisle, who passed the Climate Commitment Act, which was really huge. We also just passed a historic transportation package. And so it'll be interesting to see, one, who starts to fill that space. Senator Mona Doss was also a big climate champion. She's announced she's not running for re-election. So both of them, they're sort of voids right now. And I think folks are figuring out how things might be reorganized and what members might be on what committees. But I am tracking to the extent that I can. But I would assume we probably don't know until August, September-ish, what specific proposals will come down the pike.
Yeah, for activists, it's a bit of a challenge because the way I understand it is you really can't know what's going to be on the agenda legislatively until the legislature actually kicks off. I mean, I think there's rumors and talk about what's going to happen, but I know some states, bills can be introduced before the session, but the way I understand it here in Washington, that's not true. Is that right?
You can, but it's only like a month before. Okay. So in December, I want to say maybe December 5th, pre-filing will start. The numbers might be different depending on the session, but like the first week of December, usually you can start pre-filing bills, and then session starts between the first and the second week I think it's the first Monday of the second week of January. So I imagine it is frustrating. And as somebody who is tracking, whose job was to track bills to figure out how to inform decisions or positions on bills, you know, it's incredibly frustrating.
Yeah, well, the politics is not it's not pretty to watch. You know, it's that old line about if you're going to eat sausage, don't ever go to a sausage factory. So,
that's exactly true.
So, you know, really, I feel pretty good about being concerned about the environment and being a citizen of Washington State, and especially the 27th Legislative District. I mean, if the rest of the country could kind of track what we're doing, I would feel good. But there's always more stuff to be done. So what's your level of optimism about how well we are doing, how well we're going to be doing into the near and midterm future in terms of environmental and climate change issues?
I mean, I think we've done a lot of really great work. I mentioned, you know, the Climate Commitment Act and looking at, you know, just more creative ways to think about transportation and sort of green energy. I think there's an emphasis there. I think we've got good leaders, but I am a little bit nervous, not necessarily for the 27th, because I agree with you. This is an awesome place to be, you know, for all of the issues that I think we both care about, including climate priorities, but especially having the chair of transportation, Jake Fye, who has energy policy as his background, as my seatmate. I mean, I feel pretty good about that. But what I am worried about is what happens if our majorities, if our Democratic majorities slim down. So I think that's where things get a lot harder because, you know, nobody's a monolith and not all Democrats are a monolith either. And so having strong majorities is really important if you really want to push for progressive change. So I think my main concern is what happens given the national narrative and how that might impact some of the elections this summer and whether we can retain a strong enough majority to keep pushing in the way that we have been the last couple of years.
Yeah, well put. I notice in myself a little shot of fear to my heart when you talk about the national elections. And I also take your point that, okay, well, just having 50% of a House is probably, or a Senate is not enough. So are there state races? Let me tell you why I'm asking you this question, because I've got friends, colleagues, and we're working on impacting elections outside our own area. Part of the problem is, as somebody who is concerned about the environment, as we are, as you say, we're in a pretty darn good district here. Yeah. But we can't do it by ourselves. So are there races in Washington State for the legislature, either House or Senate, that you see as really swing elections or critical to maintaining that healthy majority you're talking about?
Yeah. So, I mean, we have some swing districts here in Pierce County. You know, the 28th being an example of them. I think one that I'm particularly nervous about is the 26th. And Senator Emily Randall, primarily because I know her opponent's strong views and they do not align with environmental priorities. Hers do. And I also just think she's a wonderful person. And I think she's done a good job in leading the 26th. So that one makes me nervous. I think it's going to be a tough call, but I feel confident in Senator Randall. And boy, she's putting in so much work. So certainly wouldn't be for a lack of effort. I don't know that I've ever seen anyone door knock so hard. But the other one I'm concerned about in particular is the 30th legislative district. So Federal Way area. I think there's some strong opposition, particularly because there's some pretty great social justice leaders that are in those positions as Democrats right now. And that's just it's a little bit of a fraught space. And so I really hope that my colleagues from the 30th are also able to make it back and doing what I can to show up and support them. So those are the two that probably stand out the most to me.
Okay, thanks. And I appreciate that background, because as laypersons, it's often hard for us. I mean, there are so many elections out there. It's somebody like you is in touch with what's going on a daily basis. And it's a shortcut for us to know what we should be looking at. You mentioned Mr. Fye. He gave us a clue a couple years ago about the Pierce County Council, you know, a swingable district in the Pierce County Council. And we went to work on that. And we feel like we had an impact on getting Jenny Hitchin elected and thereby getting a majority of Democrats on the, we love her, admire her. She's been the guest on this show
a couple of times.
Yeah,
well, thank you for that. You know, there's another tough election coming up with Robin Denson, which would, you know, if Robin comes in, we could keep that majority on the Pierce County Council. And if not, then we, you know, go backwards on all the great work that you all have done. So I would say thank you. Because I think we've seen real results of what that majority change has done.
Yeah, we don't overestimate our ability to do things, but all the effort that we put into it, we do feel like we had some impact. And that election was close enough that small changes in voter results made a big difference in the outcome.
Yes.
And as it turns out, I'm in Robin's district also. So we will be, let's just say we'll be watching that whole thing and contributing with a great deal of interest. So
I'm so glad.
Yeah. The local stuff is important to us. I mean, there are so many kind of grassroots policies that give birth, they come to fruition there, and then they impact the larger picture.
That's right.
One of the things I'm wondering about is the state government is in a position to do stuff around energy that is just the state. I mean, it's one thing to get the populace to do something. It's another thing for the state to say, okay, well, we're going to electrify vehicles. We're going to stop using reciprocating engine leaf blowers. Mm-hmm. We're going to transition away from fossil fuel use and heating and so on and so forth. So what do you see as some possibilities for the state itself moving ahead in some of those areas?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's lots of possibility. I think one thing that's great, you know, is the state can really help to facilitate resources that folks might need in making those transitions, right? So as we talk about like upgrading appliances, you know, upgrading how we get our energy, solar programs, I think those are spaces where, again, if we're able to retain the majorities that are all in that direction, it makes budget life much easier in terms of how to prioritize. But I think that's a space where I'd like to dig in. I live in a home now, an older home, like many are in the 27th. You know, I think it was built in 1927. And so we're looking at all of the opportunities to upgrade their gas, you know, gas stove. But for working people, they need support in doing that. Yep. Nobody just has a fund. Not most people just have a fund that they can tap into to upgrade their home. So I'd like to focus on how we can do that, because I think it'll have a direct impact on the health of our communities here in the 27th.
Yeah, that does seem to come under the heading of you were referring to earlier about investments now. And it's real clear that there are lots of folks that don't have the ready funds to make the kind of transitions we're talking about. Yet we're all going to be better off in the future if we can make that. When I think about this, one of the things I think about is an example, the salmon runs versus the culverts problem. And,
yes,
you know, we're spending, from my perspective, huge amounts of money retrofitting this mistake that we made in the past. If we had done it right in the first place, then we wouldn't have to be doing those big expenditures. So I think the same kind of concept applies to helping communities make this transition.
I completely agree. And I think that's a great example when you talk about, you know, what you're paying now versus what you're paying for later, because the state's definitely paying for rework on those culverts.
I know it's stunning, really. So we're getting close to the end here. When we look at climate change, we look at two things. We look at mitigation, and we've been talking about mitigation primarily here. But we have to talk about adaptation, too. I mean, when push comes to shove, we're just one state and we're a little itsy bitsy portion of the world population. And this is a world problem, unique in that respect too, as a world problem. So we do have to prepare for climate change consequences. So what do you see as some priorities in us preparing for what we can reasonably predict on the road is we're going to have to deal with?
Well, I think for Washington State, we've already seen that we're having huge population growth, and people have caught on. Our air is wonderful. Our trees are wonderful. You know, we've sort of more and more folks are coming here. But it's also, I think, how we build, how we set up our systems as we prepare for that expansion is going to be very important. Because as we grow, you know, we've got to make sure that we maintain our clean water and our clean air and our beautiful trees. So I think one of the things that we need to prepare for as a state is that that population is going to continue to grow as more people seek out those issues. But I would also relate it to an area that I've always been personally passionate about and worked on in my spare time and at the AG's office as well, which is immigration. I think we can, you know, I was born in Bangladesh, which is set to be, you know, half of the country is set to be underwater within my lifetime, including my mom's home village.
Wow.
And so when we think about, yeah, it kind of gives me, it gives me goosebumps to think about.
Yeah.
But then we think about climate refugees across the world. And so it's not just, you know, folks within the U.S. that are going to be moving to Washington, but I think you'll see there's going to be hordes of displacement, right? There's going to be tons of displacement. And so how do we have a global conversation about what to do when this displacement happens? Because it's coming. And we can only mitigate so much for it right now. But if you look at countries like Bangladesh that are on the Delta, you know, and lower sea levels, we're all going to have conversations about what to do, because those are real people and real lives that are going to be moving around as a consequence of many of the decisions that we make.
So what should we in Washington State here? I mean, I agree with you that this influx of population is pretty much baked in, and some of it's going to come with a lot of challenges. Things like people who come here penniless, who are refugees from some horrible situation related to climate change. So what specifically should we be doing to prepare for those populations?
Yeah, I mean, I think, well, it's a hard conversation because we're so far behind in some aspects, right? So when you think about housing, for example, we are so far behind that we would need a really, really aggressive way to tackle housing just to handle the population growth and the issue of, you know, homelessness and housing insecurity right now. So I think we have to take bold action. We have to all, you know, we're all going to feel the pain a little bit. I know there's lots of consternation about where to build, how to build, but I think it's just going to have to happen. I mean, it's just not a question of if we do it, but we just have to do it. Yeah. But I think the tie-in to, you know, green energy and where we draw our energy from as we build is also really, really important. So making sure that we're not exacerbating climate issues as we build, right? That we're thinking intentionally about that. And that's where Chair Fine and I have had great conversations about transit and how to make sure that we've got a lot of options for folks without, you know, sort of just contributing to the car issue. I mean, people have cars. I'm not here to shame cars. I drive one. But I think those are the ways that we really need to prepare. We need to have a place for people to go right now and prepare to build for folks that we know are coming, and then tie that into how we want that future to look as far as the impact on our climate.
Yeah, well, that makes a lot of good sense. And so maybe I could get a little sneak preview from you. Do you have any specific legislation in mind that you're planning on introducing next year, or is this too far before Christmas to talk about that?
Well, I don't like to overpromise and underdeliver, so yeah. I do want to, you know, earn my opportunity to retain this seat and think about that. But I am very interested in digging in where we can, again, help with budget and resources to help our folks in the community, you know, move along that continuum and get us to a greener space. So I think for me, that would remain a priority and something I'd like to continue working on. As far as specific policies, I mean, I suppose it would be, I mentioned I'm not a policy expert. I'm sort of just figuring out what's happening, where I have the chance to dig in. So if presented with the opportunity, I would love to work on something, but nothing has presented itself yet. And if it doesn't, then I'll just keep working on those budget investments and prioritize those.
Sure. Understood. So one of the things I hear from folks a lot, as I hear them being encouraged to be a part of their government, you know, to raise their voices, say, people have this kind of sense, well, what, I'm just one voice and it doesn't make any difference. So why should I go to the trouble of doing that? So what would you say to them, and what does it mean to you when you hear from a constituent?
Oh, it means everything. Actually, it's so interesting to be you know, on this side of things, when you're moving quickly and policies are happening. I mean, when I've had constituents write into me about their perspective, that informs, like, I think people take for granted because it does feel that way. You're like, okay, maybe if I send an email, right, or I do something, what's my 1 minute testimony going to provide? But tell you, legislators pay attention to who's speaking. And so sometimes you'll see a shift in where someone stands because they got outreach, you know, 5 minutes before they took a vote on something, because you're in this black box in Olympia. And so you're just policies, bills, you know, take your vote. So you don't have the opportunity to work with your constituents through each bill or piece of legislation. So I've seen it is very much influenced by who speaks up and who gets involved, which is part of why I feel so passionately about figuring out how can I meet people where they're at to encourage them to participate. Because I think sometimes folks that have caught on to that are the frequent flyers, and many folks in many communities just, you know, you don't hear anything from them. And I'm like, I know you care. So how can we do better about, you know, reaching out and calling you into that space? Because the political space is not always friendly to folks who haven't historically engaged, right, or been excluded.
Yeah, I guess I would say that is absolutely the perception. I even feel in myself that every time I reach out, if I make a phone call or if I send an email, there is this little voice in the back of my head that's like, well, maybe they don't want to hear from you. Maybe they're too busy. Maybe your message will get lost with everybody else's. I work through that. And I will say that when I do reach out and express my opinion, I always have a good feeling. And if I do talk to somebody on the phone, which happens sometimes, mm-hmm. I have never had an experience where I didn't feel my call was welcomed by the person that answered the phone. So,
and I'd say that maybe all the things that you're saying about being busy and, you know, all those things are true, but they don't negate how powerful the voice is. I mean, no elected official should be too busy to hear from their constituents. those are your bosses. Like, that's who gets you in that spot. So, I mean, I think sometimes the folks that maybe less enthused to hear about something are the ones that need to probably hear it the most. So, yeah, I wouldn't let that stop anyone.
Yeah. Well, point well taken. So we're about out of time. Anything else that we haven't talked about here today, Senator Trudeau, that you'd like to comment on or bring up?
You know, not particularly. I would like to, you know, share my gratitude with you for some of the things that you've shared and worked on. And also, you know, the opportunity to talk more about climate, environmental issues. It hasn't been something that I've been asked a lot about. So I would just say thank you. It's been really great.
Okay, well, thanks. I really enjoyed the conversation too, and thanks so much for taking the time with us. And good luck going forward. And just say good luck with the next legislative session too.
Thank you. And reach out if there's anything that comes across your desk that you would, you know, be interested in exploring with me, or anybody that listens to this.
Okay, absolutely. I appreciate that invitation. I will follow up.
All right. So
have a great day.
Thank you. You as well.
So there you go. Thanks to Senator Trudeau for the time she spent with us today. I appreciate her vision, her passion for serving the public interest, and perhaps more than anything, her willingness to take a sense of humor to work with her. I'd say we're fortunate to have someone like Senator Trudeau willing to serve as she is during this difficult political time in our country. You can contact me at john@ccltacoma.org for comments on this program or to make suggestions for future programs. The CCL part is for Citizens Climate Lobby. I'm an activist with Citizens Climate Lobby. Check it out, a bunch of good people. Join up or find another organization if you aren't already attached to join your voice with others. This program, along with all other locally produced Radio Tacoma programs, can be found on the KTAH website under Programming. So until we talk again, remember, always live like the mountain is out. Take care now.